Welcome to the first ever podcast from the Wales Governance Centre at Cardiff University. My name is Lee Williams and today we'll be discussing the recent general election in the company of Professors Richard Wynne-Jones and Roger Scully. If I can begin with you, Roger, you know, let's review last week's election.
Yeah.
What do you think was the biggest shock that we saw in Wales last week?
The biggest shock generally was I think, you know, the election producing an overall Conservative majority in Wales. I think the biggest shock has to be Gower, a seat that Labour's held for a century and more. To see that going to the Conservatives, albeit very narrowly, I think very few people spotted that. You know, the Conservatives had talked it up a bit. They did the manifesto launch there, but I think lots of people thought they were tilting at windmills or just bluffing. Well, clearly they weren't. And you know, they've won there. They've held their ground very effectively in Cardiff North and Vale of Glamorgan. Obviously, won in Vale of Clwyd, and they are, you know, the clearest, most obvious winners in Wales from the election, just as they are across Britain as a whole.
Yeah, I'd say that in terms of moments. I mean, what was interesting that the Patillo moment of this election was actually the publication of an opinion poll. It was the publication, or an exit poll, rather. Yeah. That was the moment on which everything hinged, and that was the thing which drew gasps of you know, I don't know where you were, Roger, but when they put that piece of paper in front of me about 10 minutes to go, 10 to 10, and it was just, you know, there were audible gasps around the room. And
yes, and where I was, it wasn't gasping, it was shouting words which I won't repeat for the benefit of this podcast.
Yeah.
There was a shock, and of course, you know, the shock was because there was such a great contrast with the polls that they'd been right through the campaign, right through all of this year. As was one of the major questions, obviously, that's coming out of this election is, well, you know, where did the polls go so wrong? I think we can narrow that down a little bit in terms of where they went wrong, at least geographically, because, of course, the polls pretty much got it dead on in Scotland. And as I'll be publishing on my Elections in Wales blog, I think, you know, they were very close also in Wales. You know, they had Conservatives a little bit too low, Labour a little bit too high, but they weren't out very much. They had particularly the two major parties significantly out in England. That's a one big part of why the election produced this victory for the Conservatives. Another part, though, is, you know, I mean, if you look at the final result, sort of project that in terms of uniform swings from last time, the Conservatives should have still been a little bit short of a majority. And I think one of the other big stories of this campaign, this election, across Britain and including in Wales, is the pretty abject failure of the Labour ground game.
Yeah,
this had been talked up a lot before the election, that Labour was stronger on the ground, the Conservatives, that they were going to do really well there. In fact, they've been considerably less successful than the Conservatives in their on-the-ground campaigning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, I mean, lots of interesting snippets during the evening and subsequently, but one of the most striking things for me is just how badly the parties themselves misunderstood what was going on. You know, it's a blame the pollsters time, and you know, obviously with the honourable exception of Wales and Scotland, that's fair enough, I guess. But the parties themselves seem to be very much in the dark. I mean, clearly the Conservatives knew they were in the game in Brecon and Radnor. They had pointed to the Vale of Clwyd as a possible kind of surprise on the night, but I don't think that I don't think the Plaid expected to lose a percentage of votes in Llanelli, for example. I think, you know, and the Lib Dems knew they were in for a fairly torrid night, but nothing on this scale. So actually, political intelligence generally was shown to be lacking. But then the other thing which I kind of find interesting is in terms of campaigning techniques. Because what's clear is that Conservatives spent a lot of money, lots of direct mailing, etc., etc. This seems to have been really quite effective, I think, more effective than their Labour opponents were suggesting in the run-up to the election.
Yeah, and Jonathan Evans was talking about this on the Sunday Supplement on Sunday, appropriately enough, and you know, was actually quite open about, you know, the way they think their use of quite sophisticated software to tailor the direct mailing messages to individual people and their circumstances was much more effective than, you know, they think Labour and some of the other parties had much more generic material going out. material, you know, putting out messages that were not really that relevant to many people. For instance, Jonathan used the example of the bedroom tax, which, as he said, only affects about 400 people in Cardiff North.
Yeah.
Yet the Labour Party was putting out direct mail and other leaflets with, you know, stuff about the bedroom tax in Cardiff North.
Yeah.
You know, it was not stuff that maybe was best calculated to actually appeal to people in a very direct sense.
Yeah. I mean, Kat, you asked earlier about what was the surprise of the night. For me, actually, was Cardiff North. You know, I know that Gower was totally unexpected in the history of that seat, but what's interesting about Cardiff North in particular is that Labour was so certain that it was in the bag. It was a seat where they'd put in one of their most intensive efforts throughout Britain. And for them not only not to win, but to lose on that scale, when they clearly, you know, and they clearly did manage to pick up some tactical voting, at least anecdotally. So Labour failed, you know, completely in that seat. And they were so adamant, they were so confident that that one was in the bag.
To look at the other parties, you know, there's been a lot of fuss around Plaid Cymru in the run-up to this election, obviously, with Leanne Wood taking part in the debate and them getting that kind of media exposure they've probably never had before. But they only managed to hold on to their three seats. You know, would Plaid Cymru have seen last week's result as a disappointment?
I think it must be categorised as disappointing. It's not a disaster. They have increased their vote share for the first time in general election since 2001. They held their three seats fairly comfortably. You know, Arvon in particular was being talked up by a lot of people, not just in the Labour Party, but others, as being a very possible Labour gain. Actually, Plaid held it pretty comfortably. They increased their majority in Carmarthen East and Dunera also. But it's sort of in the next tranche of seats, their targets, the three that they very publicly identified as targets, where, you know, they performed disappointingly. I think Ioannis Morn, okay, you know, they did get very close there. Mm. This is a seat where they'd absolutely steamrolled Labour in the Assembly by-election, in the council elections in 2013, been well ahead in the Europeans last year, still came up short. Ceredigion, amidst this catastrophic Liberal Democrat collapse just about everywhere, still came 3,000 votes short. And Llanelli, you know, they've actually lost vote share there. And I think one of the most ominous aspects of this election for Plaid looking forward to next year is that, you know, you look at some of the seats that they ought to be targeting as winnable constituency seats for next year, in particular Llanelli and Caerphilly, they've actually gone backwards.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things, I mean, this was clearly a disappointing result for Plaid Cymru. There's no way of sugarcoating it. I mean, it obviously, compared to the disaster that befell the Lib Dems, it wasn't that. But it was a poor night for them. And I think one of the things which I would be most worried about if I was a Plaid official, is that their intelligence, again, I'll come back to this point, their intelligence seemed to be off. You do wonder about their organisational capacity as a party, because they were clearly worried about Arvon. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as it turns out, they had absolutely no grounds to be worried about Arvon. I don't think that they saw Llanelli coming. I thought, you know, and they all, I mean, Ceredigion was always going to be a tough ask, but I think that they expected to be closer in. And so the difference between expectations and actual performance is something that should really worry them, because it does make you wonder, you know, what's their voter ID, what's their data like, you know, what's going on organisationally. A lot of campaigning is dull, you know, dull technical stuff. And that's something that, you know, the Tories are clearly doing very well. The SNP are very good at it. Plaid Cymru, despite, I think, sharing some of the same software as the SNP, don't seem to be able to make the same kind of use out of it. And that's about professionalisation. It's about how much money you've got as a party, what the resources are like. So it's not about, you know, leaders and messages. That stuff is important. It's about the, you know, what goes on under the bonnet. And I'd say that what this result suggests to me is that what goes on under the Plaid bonnet needs a major overhaul, shall we say.
It was a big night for UKIP. We know they came second. Well, you know, they came second in the European elections last year. They came third in terms of vote share this year. You know, is it fair to say they're part of the political furniture here in Wales now?
Well, I mean, they are now established. They've come in the top three in two successive major elections in Wales, and they are clearly now established as one of the significant political forces. At the same time, you know, across Britain, they won one seat last Thursday, and in many respects, I think this election for UKIP does have to count as a disappointment. Their vote share across Britain was, I think, below what many of them had hoped, below what they've been polling for much of the last year. Their efforts to target particular seats, again, were a pretty abject failure. In Wales, they've got quite a lot of votes, but without coming remotely close to winning anything anywhere. They also now, UKIP as a party as a whole, are in this period now. Nigel Farage is standing down, going on some sort of sabbatical over the summer, might stand again for the leadership in the autumn. And I think UKIP are in a very interesting, potentially difficult period. Perhaps Farage will come back, batteries completely recharged, and be ready to launch the party ahead. But UKIP have gone through various sort of peaks and troughs in their history, and it wouldn't be a great surprise to me to see them possibly going into another of their difficult
periods. Yeah, and of course the fact that we're going to have a referendum on Europe, mm-hmm. in a sense takes some of the steam out of the UKIP sails as well, and so that will transform the kind of politics of European membership over the next couple of years. I mean, I'm sorry I'm banging on about this organisational point, but again, one of the things which was exposed, cruelly exposed actually, during the general election is how poor UKIP's intelligence was in terms of where they were. They were making privately some big claims, even during the night, about their votes, which proved to be wrong. And I don't think they were doing it deliberately. It's a young party. Lots of people aren't particularly experienced in politics, and so it's easy to make mistakes, especially because in politics you tend to enter some kind of echo chamber where you hear, you just hear back the things that you want to hear back, and there was clearly quite a lot of that going on with UKIP. So it was a very solid performance, and it bodes well for them in terms of the list section next year's assembly election, especially given what's happened to the Lib Dems. You'd have to say that it looks promising for them, but in terms of winning any constituencies, in terms of building up a base from which you can actually hope to strike out and win, they do appear a very, very long way away from that. And it's going to be very difficult to maintain the momentum, especially given that there will be a European referendum in 2017.
You mentioned the Liberal Democrats. Where do they go from here?
Talking about them feels a bit like sort of intruding on private grief at the moment, doesn't it? I think everyone knew that they were going to have a difficult election. They were going to lose ground, but most people thought that the popularity and activity of many of their MPs would enable them to hold on to sort of 25, 30, some people were even thinking maybe 35 seats. They just didn't work at all. I think Nick Clegg actually had quite a good campaign, but clearly people didn't want to listen to the message that he was putting over. I suppose just about the one positive note you can say in Wales is that this election was further testament to just what a remarkable constituency MP Mark Williams is. I mean, to hold on relatively comfortably in Ceredigion while everything else is collapsing in such an abject fashion around you is a pretty astonishing achievement. But he's now one of just eight left, and he may well come under pressure to play a much more substantial national role now. We know someone like Mark Williams can be a very good constituency MP. Can he play a major role on a national scale now? People like him are going to have to step up and do that now.
Yeah, I mean, and I say this with no pleasure at all, because I actually think they made an important contribution during the last Parliament, not least to Wales. But if you look at their prospects, what you've got, eight MPs, so you basically it's a Lords-based party essentially, which is which is not good in all kinds of symbolic ways, and also the echo chamber effect of the House of Lords is particularly strong. If you look at the eight constituencies they've got, they're scattered. They're it's like they were back in the 50s, but worse, I think, because of course the political landscape around them has changed. So, you know, in the 50s you could present yourself as the third party. Well, now there are lots of other competitors out there, and it's very, very difficult for me to see what the purpose of the Lib Dems is. And so at the moment we're seeing, you know, we're in classic kind of five stages of grief or whatever. So they're in denial at the moment, and so basically they've got 6,500 new members, so everything, you know, so clearly they turned the corner. You know, I think it's much more fundamental than that. And I think for the Welsh Party in particular, and of course their performances in Wales of late have been, you know, even even worse.
Yeah, I mean their vote share here in Wales was worse than in England or Scotland. Yeah. In this general election, just as it was in the Europeans last year.
That's right, and that's despite being, you know, having Kirsty Williams as their figurehead, who I think everybody would agree is one of Wales's most effective and indeed most popular politicians. So I think the prospects for the Lib Dems in Wales, in particular, are, you know, it's hard to see how they actually have enough assembly members to form a group next time, let alone actually be a serious player. So, you know, I think that there's going to be a need for a very fundamental rethink as to the purposes of the party, but it's going to be a very, very difficult ask, especially given that you've got a party establishment entrenched in the Lords, you know, who will continue to go to the Lords until there's Lords reform, so that's another 100 years. So, you know, so this doesn't all go well.
I suppose the one positive you can say is, you know, some of the things that look likely to happen under the Conservative government, you know, abolition of the Human Rights Act, discussions of that, you know, greater surveillance, snooping orders, European referendum. I mean, these are some issues on which one could imagine a pro-European liberal party. Yeah, those are things on which potentially they can campaign and have something to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it looks almost certain that Tim Farron will be the new leader. He has a certain distance from the, you know, the Nick Clegg leadership, and one can imagine him sort of repositioning the party, sort of as what it largely used to be—a clearly left of centre liberal party. You know, there may be a political agenda on which they have things to say, and on which they have a leader who wants to say them.
Quite possibly, but you know, what's the core support for that kind of party? I'd say probably around 8%. I mean, the problem is, you know, I think you're right, Roger, and you know, I think we're going to see a pretty illiberal government over the next 5 years. But I do doubt, but you know, I think a lot of the opposition to that, for example, is going to be expressed in territorial terms. So a lot of the opposition to the Human Rights Act in Wales and in Scotland is going to be expressed not via the Liberal Democrats, but via the Scottish and Welsh government. So I just think it's a very crowded landscape compared to the 1950s. And to fight your way from this nadir back up to kind of relevance it's a tough ask.
You both touched there, you know, talking about some of the agenda going forward. Just talking from a Welsh perspective, moving forward, you know, where does that leave some of the kind of the policy areas now moving forward? You know, we've got the St. David's Day agreement, we know we've got that kind of cross-party agreement, but, you know, we've got 56 SNP MPs in the House of Commons for the first time. That's obviously going to be driving a different agenda for Scotland. You know, how's that going to affect in Wales? Is Wales going to benefit from that from a devolution perspective, or are we just stuck with what we've got that was announced in March?
Well, I think we're clearly going to have some big constitutional politics on the agenda for the next few years, both in terms of the European renegotiation, whatever that amounts to, and referendum, and then, you know, sort of internally within the UK. I mean, I think Scotland, you know, there is also talk about going much further than the Smith Commission. It was interesting to hear this morning's Alistair Darling talking about, you know, we need to go much further than the Smith Commission. That's already been outdated and outpaced by events. I think it's going to be much more difficult to get broad consensus for going beyond the St. David's Day agreement within Wales, not least because I suspect within the governing UK party, there isn't going to be an enormous sort of upswell of support for, you know, for substantial further devolution. You know, St. David's Day was basically sort of the lowest common denominator between all the parties, and Is there really going to be fantastic enthusiasm for doing much beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the logic of the logic of the argument that there's going to be major change is that the Conservatives have got 15% of the vote in Scotland, one MP, nothing to lose except the union, frankly. So you might as well make a generous offer and do something different. Now, that's been, and therefore, and this will then feed over into Wales, etc. Now, that's been the expectation. Thus far, what have we seen from Cameron? He's made noises about more devolution, but, you know, he's, as I understand it, instituted the same basic structure for looking after Scotland and Wales. So that means he's got an incredibly weak Secretary of State for Scotland, you know, with all due respect to David Mundell. And we haven't heard much about the generous offer that people have been positing. And if you look at what we know about the Smith negotiations themselves, and this has been, I think, widely attested in the academic research that's already been conducted, is during the last stage of the negotiation, the two Conservative negotiators were on the phone with London all the time. They were leaving the room initially, and then it got so bad that they were told, well, just stay in the room and talk on the phone. This is what the research suggests. And, you know, they were being vetoed. So there was a veto coming in from London. I mean, Labour were vetoing some things, but the UK government, the Conservatives in the UK government were vetoing other things. So there may be, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me, but there may be a group, a thought within the UK government, well, let's push this, let's call their bluff. What can they do? I think that would be extraordinarily unwise. But I wouldn't assume that we're going to get much beyond Smith, to be honest with you. And then in terms of Wales, well, the big issue, we're clearly going to get a new Wales Act or a Government of Wales Act, which will institute important reforms. But the kind of next bit of the agenda, well, the two bits on the agenda, one of which is income tax varying powers. And that just seems to be a stalemate because, frankly, the requirement for a referendum means that it's very unlikely ever to happen. And then the other thing which arises from reserve powers is devolution in the field of justice, creation of Welsh jurisdiction. This is something which the Conservative Party is divided on, but I think on the whole hostile to. Now Labour may shift on this. I suspect that now that Leighton Andrews is facing Michael Gove on the justice brief, I suspect that we'll see Welsh Labour suddenly developing much more of an appetite for the devolution of criminal justice. But, you know, that's a long term, you know, this is a government which I think is going to be in power for a while. And so, yeah, I think there may be less change in the short to medium term than people expect.
Yeah, and frankly, they're going to have their hands pretty full on constitutional matters with Europe and with evil. I suspect, you know, Wales is not going to be at the forefront of their attention or their priorities.
Shocker.
To change direction slightly, you know, we've seen over the weekend some political parties calling for a more proportional voting system. Yep. Something the Greens and UKIP have been calling for, and I didn't quite think I'd see them both agreeing on one policy, but they seem to be.
The harbingers of a future Green UKIP coalition,
yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. You heard it here first.
But Roger, you know, yourself as a cheerleader for proportional representation, you know, is it realistic? We know that the UK government are going to be pushing forward their boundary reforms. How is that all going to work out, do you think?
I don't think anything's going to happen much, really, to be frank. I mean, what we are going to see is the enacting of the legislation, which will mean a reduction from 40 to 30 Welsh MPs.
Well, although the Sunday Times yesterday suggested that Cameron, we're speaking on Monday, by the way, I've given the game away there. Yeah. So the Sunday Times suggested yesterday that they would remain with 650, because I don't think, frankly, that Cameron's got the votes. People like Glyn Davis, there'll be enough people who would rebel against the reduction. So the latest, you know, if the Sunday Times is correct, is they'd keep 650 and maybe equalise on that basis.
Yeah, well, other than that would probably mean, what, 32 Welsh members then. But, yeah, there'll be some reduction. There'll be a modest reduction also. I think in Scotland that would mean a small further cut. Yeah. That will happen. But, you know, the party which has just won an absolute majority on 37% of the vote is not likely to be tripping over itself in eagerness to introduce a proportional system. So You're not going to see, I think, anything happening in the next few years. What might be interesting is whether there's a serious internal debate within the Labour Party. I think that's the one party where it's going to be really interesting to see. Because, and basically, you already have the Liberal Democrats have favoured this for years. UKIP do, the Greens do, Plaid Cymru do, the SNP do. But if it's ever going to happen, I think you will need the Labour Party to be on board. Thus far, Labour have always been at best deeply ambivalent about electoral reform. Might that change if they think it's going to be very difficult for them ever to win a majority under first past the post again? It might. This is just going to be one of the issues as part of this post-election rethinking the direction of their party, one of the issues that may come up. Although I think at the moment my money would still be on the more constitutionally conservative element of Labour to hold sway.
Just finally, we're doing a EU referendum, potentially in 2017. What is the public appetite for that, Roger? Where are we going to go?
Well, appetite, if you ask people if they want a referendum on just about anything, they'll say yes. I mean, it doesn't mean they'll necessarily take part in the referendum. But I certainly don't think there'll be widespread public opposition to the idea of having one. The exact context in which we have it will determine a great deal about the results. So, if Cameron gets his enough out of this renegotiation process and puts it to the people, you'd expect that the vote for staying in would start as fairly strong favourites in that context. If you have, say, half to two-thirds of the Conservatives campaigning to stay in, the all of Labour, the Liberal Democrats, Plaid Cymru, the SNP and so on, much of business supporting staying in, then that side is likely to win. I suppose would quite possibly more or less put an end to UKIP as a force. I mean, if their main raison d'etre had been put to the people and voted down, then you'd wonder where they would go in the future.
It's killed the SNP, hasn't it?
Yes, but this would be a bit different.
I don't disagree with anything that Roger said. I think all I would add is that we are now in this period where Cameron appears to be walking on water, and I will strongly suspect that in 6 months to a year's time, it's going to look very, very different, and we will see deep splits opening up in the Conservative Party, because there is a large group of backbenchers and maybe cabinet ministers who suspect, I think probably rightly, that Cameron is looking for a fig leaf in these renegotiations in order to advocate a vote to remain in the European Union. And they, on the other hand, would want to get out, some of them almost under any circumstances. So I think it's unlikely that the renegotiations satisfy that wing of the Conservative Party who are, basically want to get out of the European Union. And I think it's going to get very rancorous very quickly. And it is a small majority. In fact, it's so unexpected means that we are focusing on the majority, not its size. But it's small, it's fragile, and Europe is an issue which has exploded at the heart of the Conservative Party on numerous occasions, and the idea that it's not going to do so between now and the referendum, which I suspect will happen before 2017, actually, but we shall see. But I think that these are the best days of Cameron's political career, and he should enjoy them because they're not going to last very long.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think this European issue is likely to be deeply divisive within the Conservative Party. We might want to remember the 1975 referendum, which Harold Wilson called essentially to try and paper over cracks within the Labour Party. In the short term, that worked, but a few years down the line, these divisions had reopened and indeed, had led to a major fissure in the party, with the Social Democratic Party breakaway. Yeah. So, there are still deep divisions here, and of course, what Richard says, or what I've said, we've been sort of following the optimistic scenario for David Cameron, which is that he does get some sort of fig leaf, cosmetic renegotiation, out of his European Union partners. It could all go horribly wrong, and he could get nothing out of them, in which case, things could get difficult in all sorts of other ways as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but thank you both for your contributions. That was the Wales Governance Centre podcast. We'll be back in the next couple of weeks with the next edition. Thank you very much to you both.
Yeah.